Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. What would you do without that home refrigerator stocked with beer, fruits and veggies, meat, maybe some medicine? The technology behind this necessary home household item is barely a century old, but it's done a lot to change our diets, but it's all done more to change the world. In the book Frostbite, it's an exploration of the vast system known as the cold chain, and we're joined by the author, journalist Nicola Twilley. And Nicky, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
So the big question is, how does a refrigerator actually work? I mean, how does that plug it in and suddenly everything's cold? What's going on in there?
Right. Doesn't it seem like magic? I have to say, I was a good long way into writing and researching this book when I realized I had no clue. And I think most people are in the same boat as me. For the book, I actually built a fridge just so that I could figure it out because, I wasn't super great in high school physics and the thermodynamics of it all was a little beyond me until I got the hands-on experience. But it's actually very simple, and it really relies on remembering that there's no such thing as cold. There's only the absence of heat, and cooling is that sense of loss as you pull heat out of something. So really what your fridge is doing is just endlessly pulling heat out of a box and moving that heat out into the environment.
But a compressor is a big part of that. What is the compressor doing?
Yeah, so it's you have to have four main parts: the compressor, there's the evaporator, and the condenser, and then a valve. And they all have to be strung together in the same part. What the compressor is doing is pumping the liquid, the refrigerant that we use to kind of go around the system. It's pumping it up so that it is high enough pressure that it will evaporate as it goes around the coils and pull it, again, high school physics, as a liquid turns into a gas, it absorbs energy, and that's what's happening.
So like you said, it's magic.
I mean, honestly, even after I'd built this refrigerator myself, I looked at it and I felt it was the closest to sorcery I'd ever come. It's just an astonishing thing. And I think, it's really reflected in the fact that it's such a recent invention. I mean, humans have been able to control heat. We have had an understanding of fire since before we were even modern Homo sapiens. Cold is incredibly recent. People only figured out how to make cold at will in 1755. It was a party trick. It wasn't even commercialized into mechanical form until the 1850s. So, and it wasn't domesticated into something we could have in our homes until the 1920s. So it is really recent.
And it turned ice, which was a commodity, they would ship it down from the north to, I guess, wealthy people down here in the south. And so it was a rarity, a commodity, something people would pay premium dollars for. And now to something that was more every day. I just get it right out of this machine. But it was controversial at the time. There were people who were saying that only God should be able to make ice.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what it did to our food was seen as controversial. I mean, here's a technology that can basically slow the inevitable progress toward death and decay. And that is kind of weird. Should humans have that power? It was seen as unethical to some folks or immoral that we were sort of artificially extending the life of, organic matter. When you harvest fruit and vegetables, like us, they're still breathing. And like us, they have a limited number of breaths they're going to take before they die. And what the fridge does is slow down how fast they breathe. So you're literally it's a time machine. And so a very powerful technology. And people at the time were terrified. What was this weird zombie you know, chicken that looked like it had been slaughtered yesterday, but might have been slaughtered 6 months ago. I mean, that's a strange sensation if you've lived your whole life in a world where if something looked fresh, that meant it really had to have come from nearby and been harvested or slaughtered, you know, within 24 or 48 hours. Suddenly it could have come from halfway across the continent and been harvested or slaughtered months ago. And you didn't know. You had no way of knowing.
So our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you have a question or comment about the refrigerator, the book is Frostbite, How the Refrigerator Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Ourselves. So keeping things cold is a good thing, particularly today we're expecting a high of about 107 degrees down here in South Texas. So it really brings into focus like, wow, I'm so glad that I have a refrigerator. But before we had these things, we had a guy who would come to your house and drop off a block of ice, all sorts of ways that people were trying to use a primitive cold chain.
Yeah, so before we learned how to make a cold mechanically, we relied on natural cold. And there was an entire ice harvesting industry that has basically disappeared. And at the time, New England, even, you know, across that northern swath of the United States, our cold winters were seen as the equivalent of Saudi oil today. It was this incredible natural resource because we had so much natural ice ready to be harvested every winter. And that ice was shipped around the country, also around the globe. You have that ice showing up in Mumbai, Cape Town, South Africa, Sydney, Australia. So it was a thriving industry in the 1800s and really only... We only made the switch over to mechanical cold in the early 1900s. New York City in 1907, you know, already there are skyscrapers and cars, and it was still using more natural ice than mechanically made ice, even at that point.
Let's go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and we're joined by David. And David, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had heard recently from a news report that refrigeration was actually like the second largest emitter of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So considering, you know, this awareness of climate change and this push to reduce carbon into the atmosphere, do you know of any kind of new methodologies for or new considerations for refrigeration such that it doesn't contribute to greenhouse gases and climate change?
Thank you for the call, David. Nikki?
Such a great question, and exactly why I wrote this book, because we've been so enamored with the benefits of the cold chain and bringing us, you know, produce all year round and so on, that for a long time we didn't take into account its downsides, and those climate change emissions are a really big part of it. It's actually a huge contribution to global warming for a couple of main reasons. The power used to run it, of course, that compressor doesn't run on nothing. And the chemicals, the refrigerants that the compressor is circulating around, those are often super greenhouse gases. So it's a huge problem. And I actually devote the whole final chapter of my book looking at, can we do this differently? Can we do this better? I mean, one expert said to me, if we don't, and the rest of the world builds an American-style cold chain, well, then there isn't going to be a harvest to put in those refrigerated warehouses because climate change will have taken care of that. So it's a really urgent problem, and people are working on solutions. There's various ingenious solutions to make refrigeration itself more efficient. There's also solutions that preserve food, keep it fresh without the need for a cold chain. And so that's also really exciting because, after all, the goal is to keep food fresh. You want your beer cold, you want your ice cream cold. You know, your apple doesn't actually have to be cold. It just has to be fresh. And so there's other ways of doing that, too. So it's a really important area and one that people are working on and that we really need to solve.
Well, how has the refrigeration changed the availability of food and made food more cheaply available?
It's had an enormous effect on the price and the availability of food. So meat is a classic example. Prior to refrigeration, you know, meat was expensive. If you were poor, you weren't going to be eating it very often at all in a city. And because getting meat to a city was just a nightmare. I mean, it had to travel there under its own steam a lot of the time. There are amazing accounts of sort of turkeys being herded into Philadelphia. And you can imagine herding turkeys. I mean, that's an exercise in frustration. So it was really hard to get meat into cities. And once Gustavus Swift, a New Englander who had moved to Chicago, figured out the refrigerated rail car in the 1870s, the price of a steak in New York, I mean, dropped by a quarter. It was astonishing. The amount of meat, the price of meat went way down. So it really revolutionized, because suddenly you could raise cattle out on the Great Plains where land was cheap, and you could slaughter it at scale. You could monetize all those byproducts because you were slaughtering all in one place. And it just brought the price down enormously. So that had a huge impact on what we ate.
So, you know, talking about food, you know, and its connection to health, you see that these things are, you can't do one without the other. We are what we eat. So I guess you could say that we are basically refrigerators.
Pretty much. But teasing out the impact of cold on our health, that is a much harder question, because, of course, refrigeration was introduced alongside a whole bunch of other innovations, you know, everything from flushing toilets to modern medicine. So it's really hard to say what impact it's had one way or the other. And actually, people really haven't tried to tease it out because the data on what we ate before and what we eat now is so hard to do. There's definitely some senses in which it has been harmful, and this is interesting.
So I'm going to ask you about that. I can hit this break, and so I'll talk to you about the harmful aspects of that. The number is 833-877-8255. If you've got a question, a comment about the modern cold chain, about keeping things cold, about your refrigerator, is it running? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Because of the refrigerator, we gained the ability to transport and store food over long distances, and that played a crucial role in urbanization and globalization. Cities which could not previously support large populations due to the difficulty of supplying fresh food, grew rapidly as refrigeration technology advanced. This shift had a profound effect on economies and social structure, also on agricultural practices, which evolved to meet this demand in the global market. It's something that we learn about in the new book, Frostbite, How Refrigeration Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Ourselves. We're joined by the author, Nikki Twilley. And if you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255. And so, Nikki, you tell us that it wasn't all sunshine and roses, or I guess, cold mornings and roses or whatever, but, you know, that's because of the refrigeration.
Yeah. So there are costs as well as benefits. And I guess that was one of the things I wanted to reasons I wanted to write this book is because the benefits are really obvious. I mean, you can have a blueberry on Christmas Day and there's, you know, that's right there in your store and affordable for the most part. And so it's really easy to see. We can get these fresh things all year round. They call it permanent global summertime at the supermarket because you can have anything from around the world whenever you want it. But there are some costs, and it's really interesting. One of the ones that people don't tend to notice is that in breeding for fruits and vegetables that are sturdy enough to survive refrigeration and shipping, we've actually accidentally bred out nutrients and flavor from our food. So literally in the process of making a tomato that you can ship around the country, we have managed to lose the genetic machinery that makes flavor. It doesn't exist in the modern commercial tomato. And that tomato also has fewer nutrients because of it. Lower, you know, up to 30% less vitamin C, 30% less thiamin, more than 60% less calcium. These things are real losses in our modern fruit and vegetable varieties that scientists suspect are because we bred them for refrigeration. So that's a real loss. Also, it's losing nutrients while it's in your fridge. You buy a bag of spinach, you pat yourself on the back for eating it a week later before you had to throw it out. Well, it has lost 3/4 of its vitamin C while it was sitting there in your fridge. So a fridge is not, you know, a bank vault. It does, you know, the fruit and vegetables, their nutrient levels do go down while it's in there.
They are trying to bring back a vitamin-rich tomato, the ACE tomato, which stands for vitamin A, C, and E. And hopefully that'll catch on and still hold the taste of the tomato. Let's go to Robert on the phones. And, Robert, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I can remember when I was a youngster, I saw a refrigerator that was run on natural gas, I believe, or some sort of a gas that had a big round thing on the top of the refrigerator. Are you familiar with that and how it worked?
Robert, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. So the refrigerator's gone through quite an evolution, Nikki.
Yes. And this is a really interesting story, actually, because back at the dawn of the domestic refrigerator in the 1920s, there were two different technologies competing. There was the electric refrigerator we all have today, and then there was one that ran on natural gas using an absorption system. And they both did the job. The natural gas one was actually considered to be the most likely to succeed. It was more reliable, fewer moving parts, much less noisy. It didn't make that hum that we've almost all tuned out now, but that the refrigerator is just constantly humming. And so that was the one that was considered to be, the front runner in the fridge wars of the 1920s. What happened was General Electric was very rich because of all of Thomas Edison's patents. And they looked at the fridge and they saw a gold mine. Here's an appliance you plug in 24/7 and it's constantly using electricity. I mean, that's great if you're General Electric. So they poured their money into advertising the electric fridge. They sent a fridge to the North Pole. They made a movie with a fridge as the hero. They did all of this advertising and the electric fridge won.
So the average American opens its refrigerator 107 times a day. Is that right?
I mean, it might be more for me. I don't know. I work at home. But yes, this was a study that was carried out by LG Electronics, and that's what they found. Who knows? But it is sort of the center of the kitchen these days, you know? So the hearth used to be, the fridge is now.
Yeah, and it's gotten huge. I mean, I remember the refrigerators of my youth were a lot smaller, and you know, didn't have an automatic ice machine and all those other things. We had to have ice trays. Everything is much more sophisticated now. But why so big?
Yeah, you know what? It's like freeways. Gets full up. People think they want, you know, an extra lane is just what we need here. A little bit of a larger fridge will help me out. But actually, the bigger the fridge, the more stuff you put in it, and you still can't find the stuff that's stuck all the way at the back. So it's sort of, they call it induced demand, I believe. That's the sort of technical term for it. But the more your fridge grows, the more you put in it, the more you can't find that one, you know, thing that's stuck at the back. And American fridges are by far and away the largest in the world. That also has to do with how we shop, of course, because then you have this big fridge where you drive your car to the grocery store so that you can fill that big fridge. Whereas in other countries that have taken put in place regulation to keep stores small and in city centers rather than out of town, well, then people aren't driving to the store. They're walking to the store. So then they have what they can carry. And so then they have a smaller fridge, then they shop more often. So it really has all these ripple effects that are super interesting out to, you know, the very nature of our cities.
And now we're being presented with interconnected refrigerators that are supposed to be part of our life, the home Wi-Fi, and they all our appliances are talking about us all the time.
I know. And it's like, do I really need my fridge to be able to text people? I mean, but fridges are completely sort of bound up in people's lives. I mean, one of the funniest things I did for the book was consult a fridge dating guru who matches people based on their fridges. So you can imagine the smart fridge dating network. I mean, they really are kind of, people see them as reflections of themselves. I mean, you've seen this fridgescaping trend that's all over the internet this summer too.
What is that?
Oh, gosh. People basically do set design on their fridges and set up little scenes so that when you open the door, it's all fridge-scaped.
It's like a, like the mustard and the ketchup are doing things or something?
Exactly. Based on whatever your theme is, it might be done out as a, you know, landscape garden, a musical, who knows? I mean, there's all sorts of decor that people have Disney themes. People have all kinds of things going on, which is,
All right. A lot of time on people's hands. Let's go to Angie. And Angie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Just 2 points. Maybe to move forward, we need to look backward. There's a cooling unit used in the deserts called a yakchal. Maybe it's something we could convert or look into for America. Also, I grew up in a wholesale fruit distribution company. One of the things that makes things last so long is not just refrigeration, but removing the oxygen from the air. If things aren't oxidizing, they're not going bad. That's why you can have a fresh apple in May that was harvested the September before. You keep it in the cooler, you suck the oxygen out of the air, and it lasts for months and months longer. That's all.
Oh, Angie, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. Are you familiar with the yakchal?
I am, yes. There are a bunch of traditional methods of cooling that are actually really clever, and I think looking back to look forward is a really smart move. And that point about controlled atmosphere is also really important. That has revolutionized apple warehouses. Also, your salad bag, when you buy a bag of pre-prepared salad, that has got, you know, you think that bag is just a plastic bag. No way. That bag is a highly engineered respiratory apparatus that is delivering exactly the right blend of oxygen and carbon dioxide and water vapor to that precise salad mix, matched to how fast that salad mix is breathing. So it's an incredible tool that we have for extending shelf life. And actually, one of the ways that I profile in the book for being able to preserve fruits and vegetables without cooling relies on precisely that kind of atmospheric control and a coating that will do that. So I think it's the ideas are all there for the future. We just have to start thinking about it and not just sticking everything in the fridge without thinking about it.
So customers should be demanding that they want more environmentally responsible packaging?
Yeah. More environmentally responsible packaging, more environmentally responsible food preservation, and a way to get us, think about it, there's so many fruits and vegetables we can't eat because they aren't sturdy enough to be refrigerated. They aren't on our grocery store shelves. Well, if we could find a way to preserve them using this controlled atmosphere technology, well, then we could be eating an even broader range of fruits and vegetables, getting more of those nutrients. So they are, you know, it seems great, our food system, but it's not as good as it could be. And I think, you know, we've settled for refrigeration and we could do better.
So what's going to the grocery store like with you these days?
Yeah, I mean, it is a funny thing. You know how old everything is. I mean, your caller who pointed out that apples are nearing their first birthday often when you eat them. I mean, people are shocked when you tell them that. Fresh orange juice lives in a juice tank with all of its oxygens and flavor stripped out and being just kind of twirled around like in a giant ice cream maker for a couple years. All those flavors added back in when it's shipped out. It's a funny thing once you know how your food gets to you, but I think it helps you make better choices and more delicious choices. So, you know, knowledge is power.
Nicola Twilley is the author of the new book, Frostbite, How Refrigeration Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Ourselves. She's also the co-host of the award-winning Gastropod, which is a podcast, and a contributing writer to The New Yorker, and also the author of Edible Geography. And Nikki, so good to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.